This is Risky Business for Friday, May 7, 2010. Everyone, and welcome to the show. I'm Patrick Gray. Sorry there was no podcast last week. I had a bit of a family emergency slash catastrophe that I had to deal with, but everything's okay now. And thanks to all of those who sent messages of support last week. That was very nice of you. This week's edition of the show is brought to you by Tenable Network Security. And as is our custom here at Risky Biz HQ, we'll be doing a sponsor interview with Tenable's CEO and industry stalwart, Ron Gula. That's coming up later. This week's feature interview is with Matt Olney of SourceFire's vulnerability research team. These guys have put a bunch of work into a new open source tool that can do stuff like grab PDFs off the wire as they're coming past, scan them for dodgy stuff in near real time, and then trigger snort alerts. And they're very detailed alerts. It's called near real time detection. Well, that's what they're referring to it. And personally, I think it's got legs, and we'll be having a chat about that later. But first up, it's time for a check of the last 2 weeks' news headlines with Adam Metalstorm Boileau. And Adam, it looks like China is no longer a massive source of spam, which is somewhat of a surprise.
Yeah, it's quite an interesting story, really. Yeah, it is kind of accepted general wisdom that China is the source of lots of spam and that they're all the bad guys and their machines are horribly insecure and all that sort of thing. But yeah, this particular study suggests that they are no longer in the top 12 spamming countries. US, India, and Brazil, South Korea lead that list, and China is no longer on it, which I suppose, does suggest that they are doing something to clean up their act, or maybe it's just that the great firewall of China is getting better at blocking egress SMTP.
Well, I guess, it is kind of interesting because there was so much spam emanating from China because they sort of discovered the internet about 10 years ago and also discovered NT4 and thought, this is a fantastic operating system and we'll never have to upgrade it. Let's just keep using it. And of course, they were configuring all these SMTP boxes that had, they were configured by default for Open Relay. So that was the problem with the China spam mess. And I guess, that's not a tremendously difficult problem to address, is it?
No, it's not. It's something that's pretty well understood how to fix. Actually, I do wonder to what extent it's because of localization that things traditionally had lagged behind a bit there, because the software, until I guess more recently was mostly developed out of the US, that maybe the fact that localized versions were a little bit behind the ball, so to speak, and maybe that's not the case anymore.
Yeah, maybe they actually added that checkbox, please do not allow this system to be used as a spam relay by criminals, and they put some Chinese characters next to it.
Yeah, maybe. I certainly remember once I was looking after a mail system and we were running the Trend Micro antivirus product, and when its licensing ran out, it turned into an open relay to punish you.
Are you serious? That's awesome.
Jerks.
I know, man. That is pretty jerk-like.
Yeah, totally.
In this next story, it seems that fake antivirus stuff that is obviously the bad guys are getting a lot of traction with this stuff, it apparently now represents 15% of all malware. And isn't it great that it's malware that you actually have to pay for?
Yeah, it's certainly quite a...
Now that's a business model.
Absolutely it is. And, the funny thing, of course, really is how similar the antivirus... the fake antivirus business model is to the real antivirus. I mean, that's the thing that makes it particularly funny, I suppose, in the media punditry business.
Yeah, look, if you're a group of fraudsters, all you have to do is basically replicate the business model of the legitimate AV providers and no one can spot the difference, which is really sad. And I think that's a bit of an indictment on the way that the anti-malware industry has behaved, particularly over the last 10 years as Ma and Pa have discovered the intertubes. It's really quite sad. And I think a lot of the blame for this problem really does have to rest on companies that make this stuff, the legitimate stuff.
Yeah, well, I mean, you only have to look at the way they've been trying to hype, mobile device malware for years now. Ever since we've had the first sort of Symbian OS phone come out, they've been saying, well, this is going to be the year of the mobile virus. And yeah, so everyone is, kind of paranoid. And, the antivirus companies certainly do their part in, making people afraid and, encourage them to buy their products to get some kind of a sense of security. And, in the end, as we know, that's pretty much all they're buying these days.
I just think it really is the case that the security companies have marketed themselves to an extent like a like a protection racket, you know, sort of like people who throw a rock through a window with, you know, Bob's Glaziers tied around, you know, business card tied around the rock. It's just and that's why people aren't surprised when this software pops up on their systems and says, "You've been infected with something. Give us money, and we'll sort it out for you." Because that's pretty much the MO of the typical AV company. I mean, they'll never admit that, but it kind of is.
Yeah, I agree. It is basically exactly what they do. The story we covered a few weeks ago, I think, about the similar sort of thing that popped up and accused you of copyright fraud and asked you to settle.
Oh, that was cool. Yeah,
out of court with the particular company whose copyright you'd infringed on. It's kind of the same model. I guess it would be interesting to see whether that starts to take off in the same way.
Yeah. Well, look, in another story, and this is kind of funny. You remember that kid who hacked Sarah Palin's email address? He's been busted for trying to cover it up, which goes to show, you know, these criminal masterminds like this kid who hangs out on 4chan and like hacked Sarah Palin's Yahoo account. Yeah, it's always the cover-up that gets him. He's right up there with Nixon, apparently.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure that posting her password, which he reset the popcorn on 4chan, is quite the same as the whole kind of Watergate thing. You know, not exactly the same.
Well, this is what he's been popped for, you know.
So he apparently he was acquitted of the wire fraud charge, but the jury is still confused about actually whether or not stealing someone's email account constitutes identity theft.
Just want this kid to come out and say, "I am not a crook."
Yeah, that would make for a very good soundbite.
I've got to work on my Nixon. Anyway, now look, this story, this is loltastic. This is hilarious. I love this story. I heart it so much. Facebook had to switch off chat. I mean, everyone's heard of this one already, but let's laugh at it again. Facebook had to switch off chat when it was revealed that just by doing some pointy clicky things, you could actually read all of your friends' chats. Oh, no.
Yeah, so this was it was in like the preview functionality, I think, where you could change some of your settings and then preview how it would look. And yeah, from there, you could just kind of click right on through to your friends' chat histories and running chat and see what was going on. Now, the That obviously, yeah, is pretty bad. And, you know, given the amount of, you know, what, 400 million users on Facebook, this is, you know, in terms of impact of security bugs, it's got to be one of the bigger ones lately.
Oh, totally. And it's what's hilarious is God knows how many people have been using this because it is a pointy clicky hack. That's what's funny. It's any kid out there who doesn't even know how to code in any language or do any sort of anything sophisticated can just go pointy clicky point. Oh, hang on, that's, you know, that's Bob's chat.
One of the things I think is interesting though is Facebook internal staff are apparently banned from using Facebook chat and have been for some time.
Conspiracy, so, huh? Maybe they need to be hit with a cover-up charge.
But no, apparently word on the underground is that this particular bug has been known about and in active use for some time. I'd only heard about it when it went public now, but
liar.
People have told me that it's been they had seen it some many weeks ago.
Liar.
I don't even have a Facebook account, let anyone to chat to on it, Jim.
Yeah, he's still a liar. Next up, we're talking about cryptographers with frickin' laser beams on their frickin' heads. Tell us about
indeed.
This story.
Yeah, this is a very interesting story. The clever Israeli cryptographer / engineer / cryptography dudes have come up with a way of doing key exchange in a manner that's kind of defeats observation over a piece of fiber. Now, it's the technique's a bit kind of detailed, but the net result is that even someone who's actively man in the middle and can't determine the bits that are being exchanged, and it's very, very clever indeed. The downside, I suppose, is that it does require a piece of dark fiber between you and the person you're exchanging keys with, which, you know, a little impractical, perhaps, in terms of the internet.
So you actually need a physical tube.
Yes, basically, it's involved in kind of manipulating the wavelength of the light such that you can detect an equality state, which means that you have chosen the same thing as the other end, and then the person observing only can tell that you've both chosen the same thing, not which of the choices you have made. So it's kind of that sort of weird crypto thing.
Oh, now in other news, Huawei is completely not at all involved in state-sponsored espionage in India at all. Not at all.
Not at all.
But India doesn't seem that convinced.
So this is an interesting story. I mean, we've talked about Huawei and other kind of, you know, large Chinese firms that have been selling equipment into, you know, mobile networks in Huawei's case. which, you know, raises concerns amongst, you know, regulators and, you know, military and spooks and government types. And of course, you know, Indians, I suppose, given that they're on the border with China, are, you know, particularly concerned.
Well, yeah, and that China just happens to represent an existential threat to their entire nation.
Yeah. The interesting thing, though, is that according to the article, Huawei are planning on setting up a manufacturing facility in South India, specifically to try and address some of the concerns. Now, I'm not quite sure that manufacturing equipment in country makes it any better. I mean, you know, in terms of, say, hiding backdoors in microcode and CPUs, or, you know.
Yeah, but at the same time, it's a political gesture. It's a diplomatic gesture.
Yes, but in terms of material outcome of not having your kit backdoored, I'm not sure it makes that much of a difference, right? I mean, if they're sneaky enough to do it in China, they're damn well sneaky enough to do it in South India.
The thing is, you know, my education was in electronics and communications engineering, right? I mean, do you know how many guys go off and work for the spooks working on interception capabilities for Ericsson gear that then, you know, they work with the Ericsson guys to actually, you know, do the specifications and stuff like that. So state involvement in telecommunications equipment backdoors, or what they would call interception capabilities, this isn't new. And frankly, if I was a telco in China, I probably wouldn't want to use European kit.
No, of course not. I mean, you would be crazy to.
So, I mean, when everyone goes, oh, it's ridiculous to say that Huawei, there's some state involvement and stuff like that, and it's all just xenophobia and everyone's scared of them because they're Asian. You got to say, well, actually, no, there's a long history of people doing it on both sides.
Yeah, we have, you know, three words for you. Des S boxes.
I don't know what that means.
That was the when the DES crypto standard was being developed back in the 70s. And the American NSA had some input into the configuration of the S-boxes, which is a particular kind of sensitive part of the cipher. They made a couple of changes, or suggested some changes to it. It wasn't particularly clear why. And then, some 15, 20 years later, it became apparent that those changes were made to make it more resistant to differential cryptanalysis, which was a technique that wasn't known in the public for some 20 years.
Oh, nice.
Yep. So, I mean,
oh, that's good. At least they weren't making it weaker.
Well, actually, I'm not sure about that.
Yeah, you never know. They probably slipped a few back doors in as well.
Well, exactly.
We'll have to get Brian Snow on the show again and ask him.
Yeah.
Look, in some sort of industry-related news, Sophos has been bought by I think it's a private equity deal, actually. It values the company at $830 million. So Sophos has been privately owned. I was speaking to one of their bigwigs a while ago, and apparently they were planning an IPO, but of course that didn't go through because of the GFC, and now it looks like it's been sold to some sort of equity firm.
Yeah, well, I guess, I mean, good for the guys who've invested so much time and effort in building a privately funded company of that size. I mean, that's not something we see so much of in the security industry. I mean, everyone seems to sell out much earlier on. So, I mean, good for them, I guess.
Well, Jan Hruska wrote a lot of crypto algorithms, and he was one of the founders. I met him in about 2003 and interviewed him for ZDNet, and he's a great guy, really nice guy, really knowledgeable guy.
Yeah, well, I suppose, you know, in the end, I'm just glad that they weren't bought by Symantec.
Well, speaking of being bought by Symantec, PGP.
Oh, yeah, this man made me face Palmo.
Why, man? You know, this is what's really funny is PGP. It's so funny. Everyone's owned PGP. PGP is the equivalent of the town bike. PGP was bought, I think it was in 2003, got bought by Network Associates as Network Associates was merging with McAfee. Right? So I think it was Zimmerman, right? I think this is how it went down. It's been a while ago. You can Google it and you'll be able to find out. But I think basically Zimmerman sold it to NAI for a fortune. It basically never went anywhere. And then he bought it back.
Which is a pretty smooth move.
It is a very smooth move. Sort of makes me think of Kerry Packer selling Channel 9 to Alan Bond in the 80s for $1 billion and then buying it back a few years later for $300 million. You know what he did in those few years? He played polo, right? And he came back and, you know, he made $700 million on that and said, the great quote was, you only get one Alan Bond in your lifetime. But it'll be interesting to see...
That kind of money, you only need one.
It'll be interesting to see what Symantec can do with PGP, because NAI/McAfee had a crack at it and... Bow.
Yeah, I mean, and certainly in terms of actual usability, the PGP desktop crypto products are awful. I suppose I'm sad because it's PGP is such an important part of the standards for mail crypto. But I mean, I haven't used actual commercial PGP in years. Because, of course, the open source GPG works much better. So maybe they'll spruce it up and make it actually genuinely usable for people running Outlook, and that would be a really useful thing for me. So, Symantec, if you're listening, please make PGP better and make Windows people able to use it, please. Please.
Well, it's interesting because they bought it for $300 million, so you'd think they've actually got some sort of revenue stream. I bet an NAI are like kicking themselves so hard they're leaving boot prints in their ass.
Well, what the hell happened to NAI these days anyway? When was the last time we heard anything from them?
They merged, man, with McAfee. Remember?
All right, yes.
They got good and then McAfee bought them or something. I don't know. Anyway, that's what happened. So PGP is now part of Symantec.
Yeah, and also Guardian Edge, who made, endpoint security products, I seem to recall.
Yeah, they got bought for $70 million. So I guess that's more of a technology play than a revenue play, but yeah. Whatever. Now, moving on to the next story. And there was some great controversy when Barnaby Jack... his talk was pulled from Black Hat, I think it was, a while ago. He was going to jackpot an ATM and show off all sorts of cool stuff that he'd done to ATMs. And he's actually left Juniper. Juniper basically forced him to cancel that talk. That's where he was working. He's gone over to IOActive and they're like, hey, go for it. He's doing the talk. He's releasing tools, which includes multi-platform ATM malware. He's just going nuts. He's going ATM crazy.
Yeah, so it is, I suppose, interesting to see. And I guess IOActive's position probably is, you know, any publicity is good. And, you know, giving talks at Black Hat where people jackpot ATMs and money spits out, right? That's going to get lots of people up there and they're going to see a presentation on IOActive slides. And, you know, I guess that'll be good for them. But, you know, personally, I'm looking forward to the talk. It's, you know, good fun to see the money spitting out. And, of course, Barnes is also a Kiwi from way back as well. He's one of our kind of expat security crew.
It makes you swell with national pride. Is that what?
Well, exactly. Yeah, and you know, obviously, if the ATMs swell with cash and then spit it out, that would also be good.
So that'll be interesting. I mean, look, it's kind of interesting that he's releasing this stuff now because I guess when that talk was originally scheduled, there was ATM malware out there, but it wasn't a plague, and now it's a plague. So I guess it will be less impactful.
Yeah, and certainly he's also talking about remote exploits against ATMs over the network. Right, that's something that is, you know, pretty important these days because we're seeing, you know, ATM networks that are not operated by banks, that are, you know, kind of private ATMs rather than the bank operated ones. And, you know, some people are, banks are, you know, kind of consolidating their networks and, you know, using more internet connected ATMs, that sort of thing, rather than, you know, leased lines that we would have used 5-10 years ago. You know, so I think, you know, remote attacks against ATMs are something that, you know, is very real, and, malware is the logical kind of follow on from that.
Yeah, I want to guess how fast they patch when those exploits come out. I think that will actually force some action.
Yeah, but you reckon they've got like patch management solutions on their ATMs? I mean, all the ATM vendors won't qualify that crap. You know, it'll be all, you know, XP, SP2, unpatched otherwise anyway. So, I mean, you know, if someone has to actually roll truck to the ATM to patch them, then, you know, it may take a while.
Well, I don't know, man, but a friend of mine recently has recently picked up a job servicing ATMs. So I'm considering a career change.
Yeah, that would be good fun.
Could be. I'll see you on the evil stealth yacht, you know, Bond villain styles. Long-haired cat, optional. Moving on. Oh, here we go. Final story, and this is something that you wanted to mention, which is that Microsoft has been sneakily patching some pretty hideous flaws in Windows, just silently, you know, just slipping some extra stuff into their patches. And the guys at Core are like, oh, okay, you know, so we're reversing this patch to come up with, hang on, what's this bit doing there? Oh, right. So pretty serious stuff.
Yeah, so it's, you know, when we talk about, you know, patching and the sort of the software development lifecycle for security, you know, Microsoft is one of the companies we hold up as an example of how to do it right in the industry these days, right? They've really learned. They spent lots of money. They got the smart people. And by and large, they do it, you know, if not right, better than pretty much everyone else. And it, you know, I suppose in that respect, I find it a bit disappointing that they're still silently slipping fixes into, you know, unrelated patches or patches that, you know, fix nearby code, but, you know, have other things fixed in them. And I don't really mind so much if it's, if they're vulnerabilities which are of a lower severity than the one they're patching. But when they're patching things that are, you know, say critical vulnerabilities in a patch that's rated according to the advisory as important, then that, you know, I think that does a disservice for all the sysadmins out there.
Well, I don't know. I really don't know about that because the fact is, as soon as you slap critical on something, everyone goes nuts trying to reverse it. Do you know what I mean? So to an extent, by being a little bit sneaky, they're kind of reducing the risk for customers. You know, transparency I've seen in particularly around vulnerability disclosure is a way to reduce risk by keeping the bastards honest, by keeping the vendors honest. If these guys are doing internal code audits or whatever, or people are reporting stuff to them, if they're fixing it, I don't really see that it's a massive issue. I don't think the customers are going to care that they're downplaying the severity of something that they're actually fixing. If they're downplaying the severity of something that's in their backlog, that's a different story. But if they've already patched it, I don't know, you know, sneaky, sneaky, softly, softly, catchy monkey.
Well, I think there's a difference between Microsoft shipping a patch and people applying it. Just because Microsoft have made a patch available doesn't mean everyone deploys it. If it's critical, maybe they do. If it's important, maybe it waits till the next quarterly rollout window. And that's not a decision that Microsoft should be making for sysadmins. That's the decision that businesses have to make for themselves. You know, for example, if we have a, you know, one of the vulnerabilities in this specific example relates to DNS spoofing for Exchange, right? If you're a hosted Exchange provider on the internet selling,
you want
to know about it, and that's much more important to you than if you're just an internal Exchange admin at some organization, you know, on the inside network. It's less important, and that's not a decision that Microsoft is in a position to make. That's something that, that the admins and the people actually threat modeling things in their environment need to make themselves. And if we don't have accurate information, then we can't be expected to do that or to do a good job of it.
You actually just turned me around on that one, so well done.
Excellent.
Oh, well, Adam Boileau, thank you very much for joining us as always, and I will let you get back to what sounds like your office party.
Yeah, well, you know, it's Friday afternoon. There's lots of important, serious business going on, some of it by Mr. Bex. But yeah, thanks very much, man.
Okay, we'll speak to you soon.
See ya.
Adam Boileau checking in for a chat about recent events on Planet InfoSec. Just a quick reminder that I'm still trying to find some talented security people for jobs with consultancies based in Adelaide and Sydney. So if you're an established consultant or penetration tester and you're looking for a change, please get in touch via jobs@risky.biz for more info. Next up, it's time for a chat with Matt Olney of SourceFire's Vulnerability Research Team. It's funny, but when you look at network-based IPS, they're really just not as useful as they used to be. They're kind of, you know, a little bit dowdy, a little bit yesterday. Let's just be honest. Threats really have moved away from servers and towards, you know, attacking clients. And there's only so much you can actually do in real time with a basic NID setup. This sad state of affairs has not been lost on the gang at SourceFire. As primarily an IDS company, they genuinely recognize the limitations of current detection schemes. And that's why they've been looking at new approaches that can make NIDs more relevant. Enter near real-time detection. Instead of looking for suspicious stuff in a PDF as it flies past past an interface or through a NIDs box, or NIPS, or whatever the hell you want to call it now, Matt and his team thought it would make more sense to grab those files off the wire, send them over to a system that can analyze them in near real-time and do more sophisticated stuff with them. It's one thing to analyze a file as it whizzes past, but when you have a copy on disk and a few extra CPU cycles up your sleeve, you can do some genuinely interesting analysis. One trick that this team came up with was combining all of the JavaScript variable names in any script embedded in a PDF and looking at the entropy, you know, which would typically be high because they're big, long variables and stuff. So, you know, they can trigger an alert that way. This detection strategy, because they've got so much time to analyze these files, can even trigger alerts that are so detailed. They're along the lines of, there is shellcode trying to connect to this IP on this port, and we have detected it. Now, that is seriously useful stuff. Who knows, however, if this will stick? I personally think it has legs, but I've been wrong many, many times before. But either way, I thought it would be a good idea to get Matt on the line and ask him to tell us more about SourceFire's near real-time detection concept.
It kind of got started at the SANS IDS conference in D.C., this past December, which I would highly recommend people go to. I really enjoyed it. And we talked to some folks. Mike Kloppert was there. Some guys from Shadow Server were there. And some folks from the GE response system. And they kind of ganged up on us and were like, we want to be able to pull some of this data aside. We want to be able to, we don't care about blocking. We don't care about detecting in the moment. We just need to be certain that we detect. So Patrick Mullen and I, who's another guy in the VRT, real good background in C and web-based attacks. He did a lot of stuff in the pen test world. Sat down and talked, and we went kind of two different directions. Patrick built at first an SO rule and then a preprocessor to actually do that, pull the file out of the stream. off the wire and write it to disk. And I built a PDF parser that would then we would then call. And at that point, we sat down with Lorraine Grenier, who is the team lead for the analyst group in the VRT, and Nigel Houghton, who is a just you'd have to meet him. He's a fantastic creature from Liverpool, and laid out what we wanted to do. And the initial concept was exactly that: I want to pull files, and then I want to detect them. And we built what we're calling POC one, proof of concept one, and that's what we currently have up on our lab. .snort.org site. After we got done with that, we sat again with the VRT as a whole and decided that that wasn't enough. We had gone halfway down a path which would be provide a much more powerful basis for detection.
How would it provide a more powerful basis for detection? What's the advantage in pulling a file off the wire and shunting it off to another box? I mean, why is that something you want to do?
Particularly in the IDF world, where we are, if you look at the NSS report, for example, we are judged not only on detection, but also on throughput. So it's always a balance between how fast can we get packets through and how much detection can we do. And that's true, especially when we get into the IPS realm, where we are literally in line with the wire, and if we drop packets, the network drops packets. And in today's world, with the kind of threats we're facing, where we have compressed files, file formats written by crazy people, the vast amount of obfuscation available through compression and JavaScript, etc. You cannot do all of that work and replicate the behavior of the the thousands potentially clients behind you, and still push traffic at 10 gigs on a single box. It's not feasible. We do a lot of tricks. And we can be pretty creative, but when it comes down to it, we need more time. And the advantage of pulling that to the side is, at its core, is that we can take all the time we want to do the detection on it.
So it's more cycles. It's more cycles to do more stuff and to apply all sorts of detection mechanisms, I guess.
Yep, and that was the initial thought, that we would be able to have different what we call detection nuggets. And we'd have a nugget specifically for PDF. We'd have a nugget particularly for HTML and DOM issues, particularly for JavaScript. That was the core of the idea. And as things happened in projects, it matured. We looked at it. We talked to some folks. And what we decided was, us providing all of this was not the way the world is anymore. We can provide detection, and we can provide a starting point for a whole bunch of different threats. Everything we know about, we can provide a detection platform for. But we have some very high-end customers that, because of confidentiality or, state secrets, or just because that's the way they operate, don't share data or cannot share data. So in certain circumstances, we can't provide them the detection that they know they need. And so if we wrote some hugely complicated thing where, we pulled the file and we set it aside, the PDF thing pulled it apart and it was all on C, and then we handed it back, it would be good for stuff we knew. But for the increasing amount of security professionals who build detection as part of their incident response program, that wasn't helpful. So where we moved to was from this near real-time kind of idea to a complete framework where we acted as sort of a intrusion detection router, where you would tell me I had this kind of file, and then I said, well, I know these guys want to look at that kind of file, so I would chunk them off to those guys. They would come back to me with alerts, and then I would be able to say, hey, output system, this is the alert I got. And by doing that, I can write in Perl, I can write in Ruby, I can write in Python, I can write in C, depending on, speed, safety, et cetera. And it really allows the people who are doing the edge work, the people that are doing the really serious, on the cutting edge facing APT-style threats, to do the work they need to do. And in the end, that's what we wanted to support.
Well, I mean, the thing that I find interesting about being able to take a file like a PDF and shove it off, I mean, you're talking before about file formats written by crazy people, and I think PDF is certainly one of them, because, you know, I want my document system to, you know, have JavaScript in it, don't you?
And I want to be able to do 3D CAD drawings in it also.
Well, I mean, one of the things that I saw that you guys did, which is, okay, you can grab a PDF off the wire, you send it to these other systems for processing, for crunching, right? And one of the things you did is you looked at all of the variables in any JavaScript code embedded within the PDF, and you looked at the entropy of those variables. You basically looked at how much information was contained in those variables, you know, as a pure measure of, you know, of information. And if that number was too high, you flagged an alert because that looks like bad code. So you've got some pretty lateral approaches to looking at these files, which you're generally not going to be able to do in real time, right?
Yeah, well, yeah, and that's, I mean, you can do it in real time if it's not compressed and if it's not all these other things. So in HTML line, the entropy code itself isn't actually that slow. I could probably do it in SO rule for stuff that isn't overly obfuscated. But that's an example, that idea is an example of the kind of things that we think this framework will unlock. So, for example, Lorraine Grenier and I were in Dubai talking at Hack in the Box about this project. It was where we first talked about it. And we were on day two. And on day one, we're sitting in the front row and we're having a conversation during a break about, wouldn't it be neat if we could go into the JavaScript and function through that unescape and then try to see if that shell code. And then we know that shell code behaves in a certain set of ways to look for function calls. And in order to connect back, it has to do that. So if we went through and found all that, then we could give you some pretty interesting information.
Yeah, no, it actually winds up triggering snort alerts, you know, alerts on your snort console, stuff like, you know, shell code detected here trying to connect to this port on this IP, which is a pretty, you know, that's the sort of thing you want your IDS to be telling you. Well, it's not actually the sort of stuff you want your IDS to be telling you, but it's good that it can.
But if it can, you want it to, right?
Yeah, that's
it. And the key to that, and that was kind of you watch the audience, and they kind of, you know, they glaze over when you say, well, I detect JPEG too, and I do entropy checks. But when you alert on a PDF packet and not the actual network traffic, but on the PDF packet and say, hey, this thing's going to connect out on 4444, 10.4, whatever, then you have their attention. And because of the way we're building this, and is one, yes, I can alert to snort, but I can also alert to ArcSight. I can also alert into base. I can also alert into syslog. But more importantly, I can then say, as part of that output system, hey, TCP dump, hey, Wireshark, hey, whatever capturing system you have, you need to start listening on these ports so that you know what data is leaving your network while your incident response team handles this.
Now, is there anything out there like this already? Is this something that some of the other commercial IPS and IDS providers have been working on, or is this, as far as you know, is this new?
The idea of grabbing the file offline and setting aside isn't new. I mean, we've been able to do that generically through TCP dump, and I actually found this out after we started working this, but Mike Hoppert, who's with SANS and also is with the Lockheed Martin team, has a program called Vortex, which does a very similar thing. It grabs files and then sets them aside on disk or on RAM disk for things to look at. And but the difference between SourceFire and the way that the VRT is allowed to work and what I'm seeing, and this is just, you know, my perspective from where I'm sitting, is we're much more comfortable with the idea of giving our customers data or giving our customers capability. So, and I think that just comes from the open source background. We've always been like, here, write snort rules, or here, write C rules. Now we're going to be like, here, write whatever detection you can think of writing. And because a lot of commercial entities, the larger ones, are very much like, here's our box, and here's our rule set, and we will alert and we'll tell you what happened. That is minimally useful. I think it's like the security equivalent of just patching. It's the absolute baseline of what you should be doing intrusion detection wise. And if I can instead say, here is all of this data, you know, and here's exactly why I think it was bad, and here's the output from the custom system you made all in one alert area, and I can then pass that to any alert device that you want, well, then we're talking about something pretty powerful.
So is this an open source project? Is this something that's a SourceFire commercial product?
It's going to be open source. That was never a question at SourceFire when we sat down to do it and we talked inside the VRT. But this needs to get done. Let's try to knock this out. It was from day one going to be open source. And then the proof of concept that we have out now was basically the demo that we gave to the engineering staff and to management saying, this is what we're going to do. And they were really excited. So it's going to be both. It's going to be, we're going to give the capability to do all this in open source, but they're also going to, just like the SourceFire 3D platform is now, provide a management framework that is much more scalable in the enterprise sense.
Yeah, so it'll be open source in the sense that Snort is open source, but you guys will, yep, you know, you guys will sell the bells and whistles.
Yeah, and the bells and whistles is basically, yeah, it's bells and whistles. And there will probably, because of the way the system is built, be some kind of, just like we have the rules stuff that we publish, and there's different tiers of whatever, some amount of nugget engineering or detection engineering that will be, I don't know, either open source or pay. We're still doing that whole thing where you talk to the lawyer guys and they say, well, you can't do anything. And then we're like, well, we have to do something. And then you negotiate to some point where we can protect ourselves and still give as much capability to the community as possible. And that's really, when we sit down, when the VRT sits down, that's pretty much what we always champion, because the VRT is the organization within SourceFire that's tasked with representing the customers and understanding not just what the decision makers at companies say they need, but what we know by either talking to the tech people or by observing from our own feedback and our own research what they actually need. And they may not know that yet. And we're trying to stay ahead of the curve. And that's kind of how this went. And we're not just going to go through all this effort and not provide back to the community as a whole, because we're not, the VRT is not a, we work obviously in a commercial entity, but we're not tasked with commercial thinking like that. We can absolutely build stuff for the open source community. And that's the foundation of SourceFire. And that's how Marty started. So it was always going to be open source.
All right. Well, we can only hope that a decent community springs up around this one. Matt Olney, thank you very much for joining us on Risky Business, mate, and best of luck with the release of your near real-time detection stuff.
Great. Thank you very much.
Matt Olney on the line from the USA there, and you can find the NRT code at labs.snort.org/NRT. So go forth, have a play, and by all means, jump in the forums, let us know what you think. It's time now for this week's sponsor interview with Tenable Network Security's chief executive and all-round nice guy, Mr. Ron Gula. In this interview, we discuss everything from McAfee's snafu involving that bad signature a couple of weeks ago to, you know, some logic-based flaws like this Facebook chat thing and how we go about detecting things like that and, you know, whatnot. So consider it a general update from a guy who's been in this industry, chances are, a lot longer than you. So I started off by asking Ron what his take was on this whole McAfee thing. Was it an inexcusable lapse, or was it an understandable QA blip?
It's pretty hard for me to judge somebody like McAfee, right? I don't run a, you know, international antivirus, you know, system with billions of people running my agent. So I can only imagine what kind of QA process, you know, McAfee has, and for that matter, any large, you know, Symantec, Microsoft, anything like that. But having said that, there's a lot of people who have been debating about, oh, gee, we really need to resist the temptation to use automatic updates. Automatic updates are your friend, and I think that anybody who says, hey, we want to turn these things off, or maybe delay their deployment, I think it's a wash. I think everybody out there who was basically delaying their antivirus, you know, an hour or a day to make sure the rules, you know, didn't crash anything or hurt the application, if you added up all the little bit of delays, if you added up the amount of time that they're spending doing that versus the amount of time actually caused by this outage, I'd still bet that this outage had less impact than people's QA testing. So yeah. I just tend to think that automation is still your friend, even though this is a very, very bad incident.
Well, automation used to be the enemy. I remember people, particularly in the security community, were just aghast when Microsoft first proposed doing automatic updates. They're like, do you really want Microsoft to be able to execute code on your computer without your say-so? And indeed for, you know, other operating systems and other packages, auto-updaters were seen as this horrible, horrible thing. It is one of those unpopular things that's won people over, you would agree.
It's definitely won people over. I mean, people cannot wait for the next iPhone update, or they can't wait for the next release of Firefox. And you know, people get angry when the beta doesn't work the way that they the way they think it should, because it's people just so accustomed to having new code thrown at them that is supposedly better, faster, and more secure.
Yeah, if there's something's buggy for more than 2 days, they lose their minds.
Absolutely, absolutely. So yeah, the culture has definitely changed, but I still, you know, I mean, it's been said that I think Bruce Schneier said that the only people who can look at their own crypto and really do a good use case on it is the NSA, because they have that many crypto people and they're qualified to do it. I really think that Microsoft is the only people who is really qualified to do QA testing on, you know, their own products that do the live updates. I just look at the QA programs that people have inside a lot of ISPs and universities and banks and stuff like that. And they might be really beefy programs, but it's nothing compared to what you know, Microsoft is doing, or any major vendor who's pushing out a live update.
It was funny, actually. There was recently that update that did blue screen some computers, but it turned out that it was an interoperability problem with malware on them.
And yeah,
really expect them to do QA testing for malware infected computers. But
I can sympathize with them, because you know, for Nessus we have this problem where, you know, we just crossed the 35,000 plugin mark, and you would think that we have a copy of the internet, you know, at Tenable, but I'm going to be honest, we don't, right? But we try very hard. And the thing is we always run into these slightly different versions of we think are common releases. We've seen things where maybe a vendor has claimed that there's, you know, five releases of a product, you know, .1, .2, .3, .4, .5, and we'll find a .31A that was out like for 4 days and not anywhere on the website, but a few customers got it. And guess what? When we scan those things, you know, we find that kind of stuff. So I can only sympathize with, you know, people who have to run continuous agents and continuous patching.
It's
a complex problem.
Yeah, no, I'm totally with you on that. And it's funny what you said about those weird builds, you know. And I've seen, you look at some of the Adobe build numbers and they're like 10 miles long, right? And it's, and,
oh, absolutely.
You know, they're rebuilding stuff almost daily. And it's quite funny, because that's one of the things that's caused whitelisting to a degree be shelved, is because these guys are doing so many builds, it's hard for any whitelist provider to actually keep up.
It is, and I really see a tendency for the whitelisting people to really just basically end up enforcing Microsoft type of products, which is fine if that's what your organization wants to do. But if you are going to try to lock everybody into Thunderbird, you know, Opera, and Trillion for your chat client or something like that, I don't think that really works.
Mm-mm. Now, just one last thing I want to say on that McAfee thing is, I mean, you would think that it would have MD5s or any, you know, SHA-1 or whatever of system files, and, you know, it would know that maybe a valid system file wasn't a virus. You would think that a signature would be unable to, you know, actually flag a valid system file as a virus. You would think that protection would be in there.
Yeah, I'm not going to second guess McAfee, but I would think that they're also thinking that a virus could probably hook the kernel in such a way to, you know, make that kind of check a moot point. Or not as safe. I mean, people who do antivirus work for a living, they're thinking three or four steps ahead of us when it comes to, you know, is this an MD5? Well, are you hooking the kernel? Have you are you doing something where you're giving something to the antivirus program that the virus wants to give it to it? And there's all sorts of deception and manipulation that can be done there. So who knows? I mean, it's a bad situation for McAfee, but I definitely sympathize with him.
Well, it's I suppose what you're saying here is just because they look stupid doesn't mean they are stupid.
Absolutely.
All right. Now, look, just moving on to some of the other big news. And in the last couple of days, we've seen this terrible logic flaw with Facebook where, I don't know if you've seen the video yet, but basically someone just, you know, you can just click around a little bit, go to your privacy settings, click OK or whatever. And then, you know, you're bringing up your friends' pages, and all of a sudden you can see their chats. I mean, it's one of those awful logic flaws that is just such a simple hack, such a simple exploit that you could teach a six-year-old to do it. And then we saw Blippi leaking all of these credit card numbers. We're just seeing more and more of these web app flaws that are real old school logic flaws. What do you make of that? Because, you know, as a company that specializes in, you know, scanning for vulnerabilities and scanning for web app problems and things like that, you really can't test for this stuff in an automated way, can you?
Well, not only can you not really test for it in an automated way, you really might not have permission to test it, right? So if your corporation decided to do stuff on Facebook, it's not like you can download Nessus or whatever kind of a security auditing tool you want and test Facebook. You don't have the right to do that. It's in the cloud. You're supposed to use it at the API level and stuff like that. But the thing about the chat that really kind of bothered me is I don't think there's a lot of corporate organizations out there who are really going to be doing a lot of corporate data on there. But, you know, what about the person who's cheating on their spouse? What about the kids in high school who are into cyberbullying? And, you know, if you talking to who and that just kind of ruins your reputation. I mean, I could really see a flaw like this not being critical for maybe typical information security people, but being huge for people who are in high school and into that whole chat, you know, 24/7 type of scene.
Oh, look, I think InfoSec people do really get why this is a problem because they live on IM and they always have since they were kids, you know?
The people who live on IM used to live on IRC, and they might be on IM now, but they've resisted that going all the way over to Facebook. I definitely think there's a certain amount of newer generation people who would go right into the Facebooks and right into the Twitters, and folks who've been around, you know, 10, 15, 20 years and who are still using email, you know, it's two different cultures. Absolutely.
Yeah, no, you're right. Now, I understand you guys have recently pushed out a fairly major release. Is that right?
Yes, we released Security Center 4, which is something you and I have spoke about in the past. We released it to our existing customers and all new customers, and something we're pretty proud of. So if folks want to get a chance to look at what unified security monitoring is, basically we've really made it very simple to do any type of vulnerability auditing, patch auditing, passive profiling, vulnerability scanning, configuration auditing, but then at the same time combine that with log analysis and event analysis. So if you want to do intrusion detection analysis, if you want to look for login failures to your PCI servers, it's very easy to blend both of those things into one centralized dashboard and alerting system. We got a lot of really cool videos over at tenablesecurity.com, and I invite anybody over to check it out and you know, let us know what they think about it.
Yeah, is there any way they can like download it and play around with it, or is it one of those things where you just have to see the demos and then, you know, commit to it? Because I imagine setting it up would be, you know, as simple as it could be, but it could be, you know, still a fairly significant undertaking.
It's significant in that you really need to think about what you're doing. Like if you're going to gather logs from 20 servers and you want to do credentialed scans from 20 servers, you can do that with Nessus and a syslog server, right? But if you really have an organizational need for, you know, scheduled continuous monitoring, whether it's passive analysis, log analysis, auditing scans, you know, different things like that, and you're really trying to minimize the cost of demonstrating compliance, or you're really trying to find some metrics for badness, you know, which are your most critical vulnerabilities, your most critical events on your network, you know, Security Center can really help you with that. But, you know, if people just want to scan a network and see something, I mean, we offer the Nessus home feed for that, and we actually offer the Nessus professional feed for organizations who just want to get a commercially supported, you know, vulnerability option to do, you know, patch configuration and vulnerability auditing. We position Security Center more for enterprise customers who need to have some sort of continuous monitoring.
Well, Ron, congratulations on the latest release, and thank you for joining us, as always, on Risky Business.
Hey, thanks for having me. Good luck with your fall season in Australia.
Ron Guler on the line from the USA there, sharing his perspective on a few topics. And that's it for this week's show. This week's track is Spare Change by David Snellgrove. It's off a bass concept EP he's done, which is still a work in progress, but I think it's pretty cool. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.